This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with the hosts of Louisiana Public Broadcasting's The State We're In, Charlie Winham and Shauna Sanford. They're celebrating their fifth anniversary together on this show today. So we'll talk with them about what's happening in our state and on the longest running television program in this state, I believe. 1976, it began with Beth Courtney and is still going strong. Also on the show, political consultant Scott Wilfong on the 20th anniversary of the Brady Bill being passed. And we'll hear from the well-known crime novelist Patricia Cornwell. Her latest work is called Dust. She sold 100 million books. We'll talk with Patricia Cornwell. But now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We begin with the hosts of Louisiana, the State We're In, Charlie Winham and Shauna Sanford. They've been together for 5 years now, and they have done great work and award-winning material on the State We're In, the only statewide news magazine and one of the longest-running television programs in the nation. Started in 1976, the bicentennial year, with Beth Courtney as the host, who's now the president of LPB. And good morning to you, Charlie and Shauna. Good to have you back.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Absolutely.
Nice to talk with you. Well, you have, been involved with the only 5th District congressional debate between the two candidates, one of whom will be the successor to Rodney Alexander, Neil Reiser, mm-hmm. and Vance McAllister. How was that experience?
It was great. It was a special edition of our weekly show, Friday night at 7, and it was a live version. And I think the debate went over well. It gave our viewers a great opportunity to see both these candidates at length, see what their positions are, even though they may agree on a lot of issues. It gave a chance to find out some of the differences and a chance to see their personality.
Yeah, we had Stephanie Grace, who's a political columnist mm-hmm. with The Advocate. We also had Dr. Joshua Stockley. He's a political science professor and analyst at ULM. And along with myself and Charlie, we were all part of the panel. And I thought it was very interesting. And I think it really did give the viewers, and particularly those in the 5th District, a real chance to see the subtle differences between these two candidates, because they do agree on so many things. But there were some differences that came out, and hopefully people were paying attention, and they're going to take this race very seriously, Jim, because, you know, the first time during the primary, the voter turnout was so low, mm-hmm. and the prediction is that it, you know, will be even lower this time around. But it really is such an important race, and, you know, we wanted to take time out to give these candidates an opportunity to talk about the issues and to put it out there before the voters and hopefully give them something more to think about as they go to the polls to vote.
The runoff is this Saturday. What are some of the subtle differences that were noted in their debate?
Well, I think maybe with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that probably was the biggest difference between the two. Of course, Senator Neil Reiser has been on record as saying that he wants to defund and repeal the Affordable Care Act. Vance McAllister's position is that it's here to stay. There are some problems, and that his goal would be to work on fixing what is wrong with the Affordable Care Act. We specifically asked them, you know, what are your specific plans to replace mm-hmm. the Affordable Care Act? Because Vance McAllister also wants to replace it, but he says in the meantime, it's here, so let's fix it. And I got to tell you, it was really interesting to hear their answers that centered around job creation and pooling together resources of different companies. It was really their responses were really very interesting to that question.
Well, hopefully there will be a larger turnout than expected, but it could be below 20%. And the interesting thing is that with two Republicans, there is a Democratic majority in that district.
That's right.
And the Democrats will ultimately decide who succeeds Republican Rodney Alexander, an erstwhile Democrat. And it's a special election. This has been an off year for Louisiana. Without this, we really wouldn't have had any major elections. But next year looms as is an interesting one, and I'm sure LPB will cover with earnest and vigor the Mary Landrieu campaign, and her primary challenger right now is the congressman from Baton Rouge, Bill Cassidy.
Right. What makes it such a treat to be working at LPB is that, you know, viewers can count on us to provide those type of debate formats consistently throughout the years. LPB has a strong history of having I don't want to necessarily say the quintessential debate, but certainly the debate the entire state can count on, that they can depend on our resources to be able to give a detailed and, mm-hmm. and informative debate that covers the entire state.
It's been a tradition and a good one, but Bobby Jindal in 2011 opted not to participate. Was that a disappointment?
It's always a disappointment when you can't have the candidates sitting down to discuss things. That's always going to be an issue, whoever the candidates are. In fact, for this congressional debate, right after that primary of 14 people that mm-hmm. were running for the race, as soon as the results were in, then Sean and myself and Beth and others at LPB said, let's put the invitations out early and often and get hopefully two yeses. One candidate responded fairly quickly, another candidate not so much, but we kept pressing. But that clock's ticking. It's a shot clock until you can finally get an opportunity to then finally officially say we can host a debate. So there's always a whole lot of fun. And what was that, about a two-week turnaround,
I think? Turnaround. It was really quick. And, you know, voters are going to have to mm-hmm. go through this process again in the 5th District because, you know, this is not this is only for a short period of time with Rodney Alexander retiring early.
Congressional seats will be back up next year.
Exactly.
And if Cassidy stays in the Senate race, then there will be an open 6th District seat.
There you go.
Now, last election in 2010, when Bill Cassidy was running for re-election against a couple of nondescript challengers, to his credit, he showed up for a debate at the Baton Rouge Press Club. He didn't have to. He had certainly more to lose than his challengers. Mm-hmm. But one of the questions was about public broadcasting, and he said he would do away with any funding. In fact, he even said, I'm going after Big Bird. That must have been somewhat of a cause for chagrin at LPB headquarters?
Certainly. I mean, we certainly inside LPB know the importance. And then outside of the LPB walls, we're always emphasizing just how important public broadcasting, not only to the state, but for the entire country is. It's simple to minimalize when you may want to, in the name of budget cuts, say, here we can save this much money this quickly. It's not that substantial. And when you consider the investment that not only the state but federal funds help, along with viewers like you that can give funds to help us support it, we've for 30, 40, close to 50 years now have been teaching children how to read. We have Sesame Street that has gone multi-generational, and all around the world. Public television is more like the public library for society, opposed to, hey, let's just let business take over and handle things.
Right, and we provide, I think, a very valuable resource for teachers mm-hmm. and for students. We've been doing that for a very, very long time. And it is just a wonderful resource for so many people. I mean, we have an opportunity to, with our show in particular, bring so many wonderful stories from all around the state mm-hmm. to the state. So. And, and I have to say that Congressman Cassidy has never turned down an invitation to be on our show. I mean, anytime we call him to talk about anything, he's always there, always eager to be on the show.
He just doesn't want any taxpayer money to be used to facilitate the show.
Right. We'll work with all our challenges as best we can.
Well, that was the same position that Bobby Jindal held, too. 297-5633 is your number for Charlie and Shauna of LPB and Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning to your guests. I guess I have a problem with LPB.
Okay.
Because it seems to have gotten away from its original intent, and that was for communities of people of color and for children. And I don't hardly see any original Louisiana programming geared toward that.
Okay. I'm very happy to hear that question because I know we can discuss that on many fronts. I know Sean has worked on a few stories of significance to the African-American community in Louisiana with the Rosenberg schools. I'll let you talk about that. And there's a three cheers for Pinu Green. I'm just chomping at the bit to tell you about a story that was a wonderful African-American family who they found out their father was a Congressional Gold Medal winner because he was a Montford Point Marine. But I get ahead of myself.
Yeah, and Charles, I really do appreciate your question, and I think it's a valid concern that you do have, and I want you to know that we certainly are going to take it to heart, and we'll discuss it and would love to talk with you more. You may have some ideas, and that's one of the things that we always tell folks is that we are always open for suggestions and ideas that you have for programming that you would like to see. We're always open to that. One of the things, for example, that has just recently come to us that I'm really happy to be working on, and we haven't started it just yet, but we're in the beginning phases, is a story on the first African-American nurses here in Baton Rouge. It's a wonderful story. Several of the ladies are still living, and they are vibrant and wonderful. I've had a chance to meet them, and we are in the process of putting that story together. What Charlie was referring to is a story that I did. Actually, it was a two-part story that I did on the Rosenwald schools, which were discovered by Kathy Hambrick, who is the founder and curator of the African American Heritage Museum there in Donaldsonville. And she was looking for old wooden schoolhouses, and she stumbled upon a schoolhouse and convent and found that it had an incredible, incredible history, which was founded by Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington. And as it turned out, they were responsible for building more than 5,000 schools within the southern states that were specifically designed for the education of African American children in the rural South. And what those two came together to do was just incredible. But that's a part of history that very few people were aware of. Certainly, Kathy wasn't aware of it until she discovered this schoolhouse. I wasn't aware of it. And so we were able to come together and bring that story to life and share it with our viewers. It's online now if you care to see it. And there are lots of other stories as well. We did a story on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. We discovered the Louisiana Diary, which was all about what happened in Plaquemine, the small town of Plaquemine in 1963, there at the Plymouth Rock Baptist Church, which is such an incredible part of history. And that documentary is not a reenactment, but it is actually what was going on in Plaquemine at that time. It was a documentary that was put together by KQED. We not only aired that story, but we actually had folks who were there that night when things erupted and it was complete and total chaos. And this was just right after the March on Washington.
Okay. Last year, the Advocate, as it does every year, listed its top 10 stories for 2012. What do you think the top story was? 2012, you recall? How quickly we forget.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the top story by the Advocate, and of course this is subject to conjecture, but developing sinkhole forces evacuations in Bayou Corn.
Yeah.
And up until that point and several months thereafter, the governor had not visited the sinkhole. Ultimately, he did. But that's a story that has not gone away.
No, yeah. It certainly has not. And I think there are a number of organizations, including the Advocate, doing a wonderful job of continuing the story. I think LPB, we have a unique opportunity to continue following that story in depth. Lieutenant General Russell Honore has really taken the baton to help keep that story alive, not only in the state, but throughout the nation. And we've had Lieutenant General on the air several times, as well as many residents of Bayou Corn to just hear their latest situation. This Friday is a special gathering of residents and General Honore. There's a whole lot more, obviously, to be said. That Blue Ribbon panel that was talked about months, if not half a year ago, I'd like to hear about what things have come out of that, let alone what the residents are saying for now and for the ultimate future.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. We'll return with Charlie and Shauna from LPP, and in just a bit we'll hear from consultant Scott Wilfong back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, or 297-5633 locally. And our guests for a few more minutes, Charlie Winham and Shauna Sanford, the co-hosts of The State We're In, Louisiana Public Broadcasting's widely heralded show that airs on Friday nights statewide, including right here in Baton Rouge. And Charlie, you have a show or a feature coming that will be nationally exposed and featured.
That's correct. PBS NewsHour Weekend launched this past September with Hari Srinivasan. Because of that, they are actively looking for more local or more content from PBS affiliates. So we constantly tell them there's different stories that may be of interest to our to their viewers on a national scale. They accepted a story that I put together a few weeks now, a few months back on the tiger shrimp, the invasive species in the Gulf of Mexico. And so that story, which aired previously on Louisiana The State We're In, will be scheduled to air 5 o'clock from Saturday afternoon on LPB and around the nation, which is pretty neat.
Hugh at LSU. Hugh, good morning. You're on with Charlie and Shauna.
Yes. How are you doing? I have enjoyed your show a lot, and I try to look at it when I get back to town. But don't you really think that, I mean, as General is always saying, don't we really need to attract businesses to come in to our state to produce these sinkholes?
To produce them? I think Hugh's being a bit tongue-in-cheek there, but obviously there's a problem, and there are some folks who are getting impatient about it.
No, and for all the right reasons. I mean, goodness, think about this. They're going to be celebrating their second holiday season with this huge problem. Some folks have decided to stay in their homes. Many have decided to evacuate and sell, and the headaches involved with trying to be compensated in a fair manner. It's a nightmare. No doubt about it. It is a living, continual nightmare for the folks of the Bayou Corn community.
Richard downtown. Hi, Richard. You're on with Shauna and Charlie.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine.
Doing good. Hi, Richard.
Great. Hi, everyone.
All right. I'm sorry. There we go. Are you there, Richard?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm getting some type of interference.
Well, we can hear you.
Cool. All right. Well, before I get on to my initial comment that I wanted to make, I wanted to say, first of all, that I would be so afraid to live anywhere around a sinkhole. I couldn't go to sleep at night. I'd be afraid I'd be swallowed up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So God bless those people, and yes, hopefully
indeed.
All that works out.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
But secondly, I really enjoy LPB. I really enjoy NPR, by the way, as well. I was just wondering what you guys could do to put more things on LPB that had to do with music. And, of course, I check you guys out all the time, and I see everything that comes through. But I'd just like to see more, especially live performances and mm-hmm. interviews with iconic artists and otherwise.
Wow, that's great, Richard, and thank you so much for watching and for listening this morning and calling in. And we've actually had conversations about perhaps working on projects that would involve live music. Let me tell you something. It takes a lot. It really does. There's a lot that's involved, and so those conversations continue, and it's something that we certainly will continue to work on. But believe you me, there are lots of other people who are interested in the very same things that you are.
Did get a question about Dr. Ronnie Whitfield. He's still doing this.
That's right. Yes, we have our Prescription for Health with Dr. Ronnie Whitfield that comes on the first Fridays of every month. And we've covered so many topics. He's fantastic. He's mm-hmm. just a fantastic person, wonderful doctor, and a great, great guest. We've covered topics from breast cancer awareness to childhood obesity to the free health clinics. And this Friday, he will be on. And we're going to be talking about the premature birth rate here in Louisiana. We're also going to have someone on from the March of Dimes, because Louisiana has failed in that area once again.
Right. That 1 in 7 babies in Louisiana are born premature. It's a letter grade F that the March of Dimes has given the state, and it's for the last several years.
Well, we thank you, Charlie Winham and Shauna Sanford. Keep up the good work. Five years together. And I'm sure there'll be at least another five to go with those two at the helm, at the desk of Louisiana, the state we're in.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. And we switch topics with Scott Wilfong, the rising political consultant from the right, who is here to talk about a few things. And Scott, I think, has been involved in that 5th District congressional race before we get to the anniversary of the Brady Bill. But you were representing Mr. Reiser at one point, right?
Yes, I did. I managed some of the grassroots in the primary, you know, still very close with the campaign. But I was very impressed. You know, we did my company sold a lot of the signs and everything. We couldn't get signs in fast enough to get them up. So, the folks up in that area were really it was easy to get people to support Neil. And I think that's what's going to make the difference. You know, I see the race tightening a little bit, obviously. But I think in the end, those high chronic voters in that area are going to be the ones that turn out.
CB for Godston predicts a McAllister victory.
Well, you know, I mean, on paper, if you look at it, you know, the third and fourth place finishers endorsed McAllister. Being an outsider certainly helps. The Duck Dynasty folks came out for McAllister. But, you know, I've been doing this for a good while, and you know, when it comes down to it, the guy who gets a third of the vote in the primary, when there's 14 candidates and one guy gets a third in the primary, most of the time he wins. And so I would certainly predict Neil to win the race, although it's not going to be a landslide by any means.
And turnout is everything in this case.
Absolutely everything. You know, that's the question. Are the black voters going to turn out? You know, Jamie Mayo endorsed McAllister. But Jamie Mayo, in a district where blacks make up over a third of the registered voters, he couldn't make a runoff. So, you know, the question is are the black voters motivated to turn out?
297-5633 for Scott Wilfong. Today marks the 20th anniversary of the passage of the Brady Bill. It was signed into law by President Clinton November 30th, 1993, went into effect February 28th, 1994, and the act was named after James Brady, shot by John Hinckley Jr. during an attempted assassination attempt of President Reagan on March 30th of 1981. It requires background checks to be conducted on individuals before a firearm may be purchased from a federally licensed dealer, manufacturer, or importer unless an exception applies. Was it a good law? Or is it a good law?
I guess I would say it probably had little effect. There was a key provision I know that was struck down as unconstitutional. I believe the one that required the states to conduct a background check. The Supreme Court overturned that provision. I think there's something to be said for a licensed dealer, you know, determining whether the person they're selling to is a violent felon or not. I think that in the very basic level, it had a positive effect. But I think the overall statistics really don't bear it out. You know, the Department of Justice released a study this year that showed gun-related crimes are down 40% since 1993. Murders are down. Firearm violence overall is down. In that time frame, the number of guns in America has almost doubled. So, you know, the argument that taking guns away from people reduces crime, no, it appears the statistics back up that more guns equal less crime.
Was it the intent to take guns away or just to take them away from people who shouldn't have them?
Well, you know, I think it shows a little bit of the hypocrisy of the left. You know, the same folks that will argue against laws requiring you to show an ID to cast a vote because they claim there's very little voter fraud going on out there will insist on a background check for a firearm purchase when we know that those who don't follow the law really don't care about if they want a gun illegally, they'll steal one. The law-abiding citizens are the ones that will go fill out that background check and do the things that the law requires. So, you know, just more more evidence of the hypocrisy of the left.
Well, from 1994 through 2009, over 107 million Brady background checks were conducted, and during that period, about 2 million attempted firearm purchases were blocked by the background check. That's 1.8%. So some people were denied. And you say firearm sales have gone up, but I don't know that there's been a study on the people who have firearms, whether there are more people on a proportional basis who have firearms. It seems that some folks, like I have one gun, Scott, in my house. You probably have more than one gun. I bet you
have more than one.
And you've probably more than doubled your arsenal in the last 20 years.
I don't accept that term arsenal. Arsenals are for militaries. I'm a private citizen.
How many guns do you have?
More than one.
More than one?
More than one.
Less than 100?
More than one.
Jeez, he may be into triple digits. But there's nothing wrong with having as many guns as you want in this country if you're not up to no good.
Well, the founding fathers didn't think so. And I think, you know, it's certainly using data to draw conclusions and what's the old, you know, the standard about, you know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. So take it with a grain of salt. But if the number of guns has gone up and crime has gone down, what can you attribute that to other than simply law-abiding people are the ones accumulating the guns? Because certainly one would assume that if more criminals were getting their hands on guns, we would see an increase in gun-related crimes. That hasn't been the case. Okay.
297-5633 for the guy who likes guns, Scott Wilfong, and it is an issue in this state that politicians run from like you wouldn't believe. You get somebody like Foster Campbell, my dear friend on this show, and ask him about guns, and he does not. He's with Scott. John Bell Edwards, he's with Scott. What about the editor of Guns and Ammo magazine, Dick Metcalf, being fired for writing an editorial? And this is a guy who's a huge gun enthusiast and has been for years. The editor of Guns and Ammo magazine, which has 6 million readers every month, being fired for writing that training should be imposed in order for people to purchase firearms.
Well, that is, you know, I don't know if that was just a momentary lapse in judgment or what, but...
Well, what would be wrong with that?
Well, the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution shall not be infringed would be the first thing that comes to mind, but the fact that, you know, that we want to put a requirement... You know, how about let's do some training before people are allowed to cast a vote? I think that would be an excellent idea.
How about training before people get a driver's license?
I think we do have that. You do
well,
have to pass
right.
it. You have
that's
to pass
the point.
An exam.
Why don't we have it? Absolutely. If a car is a dangerous weapon, potentially, shouldn't guns be treated as such?
Except for the fact that you do not have an amendment to the U.S. Constitution guaranteeing you a right to a car.
But Dick Metcalf, who is a bigger gun enthusiast than you, he said no rights would be taken away by doing this.
Well, I haven't read his article. I just heard a brief mention of it.
He got canned.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's been the, you know, the overall movement of this country. I think you saw, you know, the biggest gun story of the year to me is the recall elections in Colorado, where two gun control politicians were recalled, one by a heavily Democrat electorate. In fact, the organizers of the recall, union members, Democrats. This is an issue that's beginning to clearly cross party lines. Liberals and conservatives, they believe in freedom. And that's what the Second Amendment guarantees us.
Well, Dick Metcalf, the deposed editor of Gun and Ammo, says all citizens have a right to keep and bear arms, but I do not believe, writes Metcalf, that they have a right to use them irresponsibly. Paul on Segan. Good morning, Paul. You're on with Scott Wilfong.
Hello. Well, obviously using them irresponsibly or illegally is a problem, but I guess my concern with increasing the already pretty stringent background checks requirement is this. When you start talking about making private citizens have background checks amongst themselves, that is de facto registration. And I would challenge you to tell me any time in human history when the registration of firearms has not led to the eventual confiscation or just, you know, the crushing of the right of that particular body of citizens to own them. And since law-abiding citizens are the only ones who will follow such laws, and since we have, by any count, tens of millions of firearms in the hands of criminals, what do you actually expect to accomplish by forcing more regulations than the 20,000 that are already on law-abiding citizens?
Well, 2 million people have been denied firearm purchases under the Brady Law over the last 20 years, and I would imagine that most, if not all, of those 2 million people shouldn't be having firearms.
Well, and but kind of to what the caller was saying in the Dick Metcalf editorial, if you require training for a firearms purchase, you've created some sort of national registry, because obviously you would have to keep a record of who got the training. You'd have to prove your training. Well, in that case, everybody that wants a gun, someone would have that information. And I think, you know, we have good reason. I've said on the show before, people in some of our citizens' lifetimes, they have seen gold confiscated by the government. Gold doesn't hurt anyone other than it just has a monetary function. To think that the government might not confiscate firearms,
does the government confiscate automobiles?
Not yet. Well, I mean,
well,
you know,
but we have to register our cars.
We do have to register the car.
Okay, Doc on airline. Doc, good morning. You're on with Scott Wilfong.
Good morning, Jim and Scott.
Good morning.
Got a question. Several months ago, whenever the Connecticut shooting happened at the school, Mr. Obama said that he was going to check into the movie and gaming industry, because another thing that these people all have in common is that they played violent games, watched violent movies all the time. Why don't we have a committee of, say, about 30 or 40 people made up of ministers, educators, and so forth, that review every movie and every game that's put on the internet?
All right. You think that's a wise move, Scott?
Well, I mean, I get his point, and I think it's coming from a sincere place. I don't favor censorship of any sort. But again, coming back to the hypocrisy, it's amazing these actors that want to come out for gun control and call anybody that wants guns a Looney Tune and an extremist, and yet they'll go make millions of dollars filming a movie where they shoot 40 people. And they think that somehow this has no effect on society. You're right. You know, I'm a mature enough person. I can watch a violent movie, and it doesn't make me want to go commit violence. But certainly, our young people and people that aren't mentally stable see this, and it affects them. We've got proof. We've seen it from these horrible mass shootings, and yet Hollywood continues to churn out these movies glorifying violence and say, what's the problem? We don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Saturday's column in the New York Times from Joe Nocera, he writes about Dick Metcalf, the editor of Gun and Ammo, being canned.
You're going to make me cancel my subscription to Guns and Ammo,
says,
aren't you?
My guess is that Dick Metcalf always knew what he was in for, and all the more reason that his writing took guts. In the aftermath, he was the only one who could still hold his head up high. On a blog called The Outdoor Wire, he wrote a lengthy response. He didn't back down, describing himself as disappointed. He added, if a respected editor can be forced to resign and a controversial writer's voice be shut down by a one-sided social media and internet outcry virtually overnight simply because they dared to open a discussion or ask questions about a politically sensitive issue, then I fear for the future of our industry and for our cause. That from Dick Metcalf, the editor of Gun and Ammo magazine.
Former editor.
Yeah, he's been fired, but he was known as a writer for magazines that promoted gun use. We'll talk more with Scott. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing. A bit more time with Scott Wilfong. And today is the 20th anniversary of the passage of the Brady Bill. About 2 million gun purchases have been denied over the last 20 years as a result of the Brady Law. And a recent development in the last week, the editor of Guns and Ammo magazine was fired, Dick Metcalf, who on his Facebook page is firing a gun. He's a guy who loves guns, makes no bones about it, is a supporter of the Second Amendment. He just suggested that it would be wise to have people trained before they purchased weapons, and that cost him his job. Eli in New Iberia. Eli, good morning. You're on with Scott.
I'm a registered Democrat, but I'm also a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment right to own weapons. My comment is, if we were going to have an honest debate in this country about gun control, we'd be talking about handguns, not assault rifles, not long guns. Our right to bear arms extends to long guns. Now, if you want to have registration and gun owner classes for handguns, I'd be willing to have that debate and support that kind of legislation. But we've got to acknowledge that our problem is with handguns, not with long guns, not with law-abiding citizens, with criminals.
Well, I don't think the right to keep and bear arms does not imply that it's simply just a long gun, a shotgun, rifle, whatever. There weren't really handguns at the time, but there were flintlocks, things like that. So, you know, the founding fathers didn't distinguish between what type of weapon. So clearly, and besides that, the Supreme Court upheld it in 2008 with the Heller decision that a handgun there's an absolute right to a handgun.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Scott Wilfong.
Yeah, so do you believe that Ronald Reagan was not conservative enough when he came out in support of the Brady Bill?
I mean, I don't agree with the bill, but I think it was his press secretary that was shot, and there was a lot of emotional pressure there to give in. It was interesting if you remember
he was shot too.
He was shot too. Yeah, about 7 years after that, however, Sarah Brady was actually it came up in Connecticut or Delaware that she went in and bought a gun for her son, and it was basically a straw purchase. But of course, that wasn't considered a big deal and didn't make a big case of it. But she was actually stopped when she tried to purchase a gun for someone else, which was in exact opposition to what she pushed for.
Maybe
with the Brady
she was
bill.
Just testing them,
like Gifford's husband, right?
297-5633. Trey on Bluff Road. Trey, good morning. You're on with Scott Wilfong.
Good morning, guys. Scott, do you know of a way for people who have been in some trouble historically, I guess, decades ago, to formally restore their firearm rights within the court system? There's, you know, federal provisions and state provisions, but there's really no one-stop shop for a guy who's gotten into some trouble and been playing, you know, by the rules for decades.
Well, you know, under state law, I know there's Article 893 and 894. One pertains to misdemeanors, one's to felonies. On a first offense, either one, you can, if you go through the steps, you can have that removed from your record. Those, to my knowledge, are not grounds to block you on a NICS check. Obviously, a pardon by the governor, a pardon by the president, but of course, those are somewhat hard to get. But I would think in Louisiana, we do have that provision with the Article 893.
Tiny in Sherwood. Thank you, sir. Tiny in Sherwood, you're on with Scott Wilfong.
Hey, guys. How you doing this morning?
Fine. What's your question?
So I think the statement I'd like to make is I'm a combat veteran for our country. I really look at gun control. Gun control historically has never been about guns or public safety. Gun control has always been about control. And the issue we face right now and the arguments we're hearing, we look at statistics and really, you know, gun control has not been a deterrent to crime as we think it is.
Well, a control of what?
Well, it's a control of free will, and it's a control of who has the guns. So if I control the gold or the guns, I control you.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to look far. I mean, we always pick on Dianne Feinstein, but the senator from California, who it came out recently that when she was faced with, you know, some threats of violence against her when she was the mayor of San Francisco, she got a concealed carry permit. But, of course, she fights against my right to have a concealed carry permit. Her statement is she'd like to round up every gun in America and confiscate them. But when she had a need for a firearm,
that. She's never said
she,
that.
She said that. If I had my way, Mr. and Mrs. America, turn them all in.
Well,
that
maybe
was
in a dream
quote.
World, but I think it was noted that is a dream world. That's not going to happen in this country. Just like we're not going to take all the cars off the road. People are going to have guns, but shouldn't people be qualified to fire guns in the same way they're qualified to drive motor vehicles?
If you ask me the question, do I want my wife, my children, when they're old, become old enough to have a gun, to have training? Yes, I'll insist that they do have training, but that's my right to require that of them, you know, before I go and
not
purchase
the right of the state.
It's not the right of the government because we have the Second Amendment. Shall not be infringed. If you know, there is a provision to change the U.S. Constitution. We've changed it 27 times. If people don't like the Second Amendment, there's a way to change it.
Mr. Metcalf has stated in print, much to the chagrin of some, that it is not an infringement, this is something that is within the realm of the Second Amendment. Just like You have the First Amendment, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Doug on Airline Highway. Good morning, Doug. You're on with Scott.
Good morning, Jim. Yeah, I wanted to follow up on the point you just made because I think that gets to the heart of Mr. Wilfong's confusion here. We do not have absolute rights. All of our rights are subject to regulation to protect the public good. The right to free speech, as you just mentioned, does not entitle you to yell fire in a crowded theater, even though you may want to do that. You cannot. The right to bear arms does not mean that you can have any type of gun in any place at any time because you want to, regardless of the impacts on other people.
Well, you know, that's an interpretation that some courts have made, but there is a distinct, there's a difference in the language of the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. First Amendment doesn't say the right of speech shall not be infringed. It says Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion. The Second Amendment does clearly say the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, is there certain public policy things that are within that fit within that? I think the courts have said yes, and I think that certain reasonable restrictions are allowed. But let's don't get too far from the black and white text of what they wrote.
Well, it's also a militia, an armed militia, but we'll live to fight for another day.
A well-regulated militia. You're right. There's your regulation right there.
Thank you, Scott Wilfong. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Patricia Cornwell, the noted novelist, perhaps the best-known crime writer in the world today. Good morning, Patricia Cornwell.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you. 100 million books have been sold under the authorship of Patricia. It's been quite a ride for you over the last few years.
It has been quite a ride, and it's feel very, very, very fortunate that the Scarpetta series has done so well and that I have the privilege of doing things like this, talking to someone like you.
Well, Dust is the latest, finding Kay Scarpetta at the top of her field as chief medical examiner and director of the Cambridge Forensic Center. What's the major focus of Dust?
Well, the major focus, it's interesting because I was just catching the tail end of what you were talking about with guns, which brings to mind, you know, the sorts of cases that we've been hearing about, these shootings in public places that have caused such an uproar in so many ways. And there's a certain overlaying of that kind of thing on the theme in Dust, which is Scarpetta's dealing with an assailant who her FBI husband has labeled a spectacle killer, a type of person who, whether it's someone who goes in and shoots up a movie theater or a marathon bomber who ends up on the cover of Rolling Stone or some other type of a murderer who is getting a rush from the types of, from the attention that is garnished from all this. And it's a different most dramatically we think of Columbine, where we began to see evidence of people that plot and plan and want to do something to be a somebody, even if it costs a lot of lives, including their own.
And you include the real-life Sandy Hook mass shooting into this novel. How so?
I do. I don't go there. We don't work that case. But Scarpetta is just returning from having assisted her colleagues in Newtown, Connecticut, because it's very close to her jurisdiction, and that's obviously what she would do. And I wanted to explore not only the trend in crime that we're seeing things like this today, and I didn't used to see anything like this in the early days of my career, nor did Scarpetta, and also what does it do to her? What does this do to her? How does this tear the fabric of her being, not only the horror of dealing with these little children, but also these types of crimes, you don't even have to solve them because they're already solved by the time you get there. So it's not like she has the gratification of locking somebody up. But how do you track who's going to do it next when it's a one-shot, so to speak, ordeal where someone goes in and shoots and then they're either dead or in a coma or in a hospital or who knows what, but they're captured. And even her FBI profiler, husband Benton, says profiling does no good in a case like this. I can't in any way figure out who's going to be influenced by all the publicity of this and decide that he's going to be the next one to do it.
Well, the new enemy, as Kay Scarpetta calls it, is a dramatic public display by people addicted to attention and fame. It's an interesting concept.
Well, we certainly live in a culture where people are addicted to attention and fame, and everybody thinks it's their not only a likelihood, but maybe their right to be famous. And when I was growing up, that just wasn't true. I don't think anybody I went to school with thought they were going to grow up and be famous or that they could. You had to be really good at something to be famous. Nowadays, you don't have to be good at anything to be famous.
You're pretty good, and you became famous.
Well, I've worked very hard, and actually my ambition wasn't to be famous. It was to be published, and then the other followed suit. But I think you know what I mean. You don't have you can be outrageous. You can be badly behaved and end up on a TV show, or you can commit a terrible crime and, like I said, be on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. So that's these are cultural and societal problems. And frankly, I'm asked often, you know, what do we do about this type of thing? I mean, look at the shootings that we've had since Newtown. And the answer is not simple, and it's not something you can legislate. It is complex. We're talking about people and why we have created what I consider almost a walking dead type of individual who cares about nothing and nobody.
Patricia Cornwell is our guest for a few more minutes. She is the author of Dust. Over the last 3 decades, she has written 21 brilliant novels and has the numbers to show for it, 100 million copies published in 120 countries and 35 languages. There's a lot of new technology in Dust. You have to stay aware of what's happening on all the technological fronts, military-grade drone phones, progression immersion theater. You're up to date, and so is Kay Scarpetta.
That's the fun. I get to go out and see the newest cool things that people are doing, and then I say, you know, Scarpetta fortunately doesn't seem to have the budget problem everybody else does, so she's going to have one of those theaters, she's going to have one of those CT scanners, and I'm going to show everybody how it works.
I'm sure you're not surprised, but we've had a few listeners who wanted to ask you about your remembrances of being in Baton Rouge when we had a serial killer on the loose.
Oh, my goodness, it's such a huge part of my life, working on that documentary with Diane Sawyer, and then most of all getting to know the family members of the victims, becoming very close to a number of these people who I'll never forget the first time I came down there doing, and I ended up spending the better part of a year in and out of Baton Rouge working on that case. And the first time I came down, some of the family members came up to me and said, oh, thank God Scarpetta has come to help us solve this. And I was so moved by that, and I thought, if only I could really send her in, because she would take care of things. But and I'm also good friends with your former coroner, Dr. Cataldi, and so I have a lot of very strong and fond memories and scary memories too of Baton Rouge.
Yeah, you were here when they were trying to find the serial killer, and ultimately they did, and Derek Todd Lee. He was not the traditional kind of profile, though, was he?
No, but I will tell you, the first time I read about these cases, and I think it was right after the second one, might have been right after Murray Pace, I'm not sure, but I remember I was actually in Salem, Massachusetts, and I was reading the newspaper, and I came across an AP story about what was going on in Baton Rouge, and I looked up and I said to the people with me, this is going to be another Jack the Ripper. This is going to be a really tough crime to solve. This is going to be somebody they don't imagine. And then, lo and behold, I ended up getting involved in it. But that remains, in my mind, one of the most harrowing series of crimes that I've pretty much ever come across. Just diabolical. This guy is very, very cunning.
Very cunning, but most serial killers are thought to be smart and charming and maybe handsome. And in this case, there was nothing exceptional in the past about Mr. Derek Todd Lee, but he somehow, some way, enabled women to open their doors for him and pay the ultimate price. It was
tragic. Well, he was a tenacious stalker, and you watch somebody enough, and you will find out their patterns or where they leave their keys or that they come in to eat lunch and don't lock their door and watch TV for an hour before going back to school or whatever. And I know one of the victims, I think, opened the door because he pretended he needed to use a phone or something, but I think mostly he found a way to access the residences. These were people very similar to my first book, Postmortem. They're minding their own business in their own homes, and somebody finds a way to get in. And a very, very, they're very violent, incredibly disturbing cases. And I'll never forget that episode of being in Baton Rouge and living through all that with a lot of your very fine people.
But this was from a man whose IQ was tested, and I think he was like 70 or 80, very low intelligence quotient. How could he pull something like this off?
Well, it's like any sort of predatory. It's like it's a predator, somebody that knows how to watch and to follow and when to strike. You don't have to be all that smart to do what he did. And, these people, they're as different as any human beings can be different. Some of them are very attractive and very bright, and a lot of them aren't. They're driven by compulsion, and their compulsion is to get sexual gratification through violence. And somebody lights up on their radar, and they spend enough time watching. I mean, as you may remember from the Murray Pace case, I think she had moved away from the neighborhood where the first victim, Christine Green, was killed because...
All right, we've got to roll, but Patricia Cornwell writes about crime and knows about it like no one else. Her latest work is Dust. Thank you, Patricia. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.